Tonight on Arena. We review Amadeus and Emily in Paris, suggest the best TV over Christmas, and Adele Coffey has present suggestions for the reader in your life. You are very welcome to Friday night's Arena. Text us on 51551. The WhatsApp is 0870 32 32 32. You can email arena at rte.ie, and we are on Instagram at rte underscore arena. As it's Friday night, it is time for the last TV review of the year. Tonight we're looking at the final season of Emily in Paris / Rome on Netflix, and a new adaptation of Amadeus on Sky Atlantic and Now. And for the season that's in it, we're also going to look ahead to some special TV shows and new series in the overwhelming amount of television you could be watching during the Christmas period. Joining me now, as always, are our reviewers, Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser. Starting with you, Chris, you watched Sky's Amadeus. It's a new series that reimagines Peter Shaffer's play, which then became Milos Forman's Oscar-winning film, set in a lavish 18th century Vienna. Will Sharp is the brilliant rebellious young Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. Paul Bettany is his tormented rival, Antonio Salieri. So where does the whole start for us?
It starts, as I suppose the film and the play did, you know, in 18th century Vienna, where 25-year-old Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, played here by the brilliant Will Sharp, who's not so brilliant in this, he has just arrived in Vienna with a belly full of wine and a head full of music. And news has spread of this former child prodigy who is all grown up and, you know, looking for a place to kind of, you know, write his next masterpiece. But I don't think the people who are celebrating him before they've met him expect this rock star of a chap to show up. You know, he's quite boozy. He's, you know, a bit of a womanizer. And a guy who is looking forward to meeting him but is just constantly disappointed by him is Antonio Salieri, who is this court composer for the Emperor Joseph, played by Rory Kinnear. Rory Kinnear enjoying himself very much here. And he's this composer who has maybe had his day. He never had as exciting a day as Mozart, but it's been quite some time since, you know, he even excited himself with his music. He has constant writer's block. He's a God-fearing man who believes that, you know, music comes from the heavens and that God has completely given up on him. And though he was excited to meet Mozart, he's just disappointed when he sees him. He thinks, you know, this guy doesn't deserve the talent that he has. And he thinks that Mozart is quite, you know, reckless with that talent. So he kind of, Salieri, there's a rivalry between these two men, but there's an idea that maybe that only one of the men is aware that there's a rivalry. Mozart is just too busy being a genius all of the time and enjoying himself. But Salieri is so jealous and so annoyed by him that he kind of hatches this plan, I'm going to take this man down. So around this story, then you have Salieri in the future, Paul Bettany, wearing prosthetics to make him look older, we'll come back to that, talking about how he decided not long after meeting Mozart that I was going to kill this man. So this sort of, it's going back to the original play and the original rumour that, you know, was Mozart killed by Salieri? And I should mention too that it also follows the story that Mozart, as soon as he arrives in Vienna, meets the woman he's going to marry. Her name is Constanza, and she is played by Gabrielle Creevy.
Okay, I'm going to start with something from it. This is the court composer Salieri meeting with Emperor Joseph to discuss musical events at the palace. It is Paul Bettany as Salieri and Rory Kinnear being Rory Kinnear and the Emperor as well.
The thing with change, though, is that people aren't very keen on it, even if it's in their best interests. So, I shall need every trick at my disposal. Do you know what opera is?
Yes. Well, what do you think it is, sir?
Power. Kings and queens, friends and foes, they will all come here. They will see our palaces, they will see our armies, and they will see our operas, grander and finer than anything that London, Prague, or St. Petersburg has to offer. I cannot overstate its importance to the Empire.
Of course, Your Majesty, and it's an honor to serve the crown.
Good. So I would like you to put on a remake.
A remake?
Your opera, Tarare, the French one. I'd like a version for us, but not in French, though. Do it in Italian.
Yes, I did rather have my sights set on newer compositions.
Well, save them. A return to past successes is what's needed in delicate times.
If I told you that was a clip of Nicol Trowbridge from The Diplomat, I mean, you could easily close your eyes and believe that. But
yeah.
I'll listen to Rory Kinnear being Rory Kinnear all day long.
Yeah, I mentioned that he's enjoying himself here, and I enjoyed him too. He was one of the standout performers for me. I think the problems begin at the very beginning, even before the show went into production. This idea that of how do you improve upon the film by Milos Forman. Like, there, you just can't. And I don't really believe that Joe Barton, who gave us The Lazarus Project and Black Doves, maybe went into it thinking, I'm going to do a better Amadeus over five episodes. I'm going to do something that they didn't already cover in the film. I think maybe he's just sort of, I want to leave my own mark on the story. And that's his right to do that. But it's just, there are things not working about this. I think it's there are problems with the performances. There are problems with the tone. I mentioned the aging process, the idea of Paul Bettany being aged up, playing this older Salieri who's talking to an older Gabrielle Creevy. That doesn't really work. The makeup is not great here.
Gabrielle Creevy's in particular seems strange.
It is strange, you know, and there's a massive budget here, and you can see it in some places, but clearly it hasn't really gone into the makeup. And you can, you know, you can put as much effort as you want into prosthetics, but when the actors are moving too quickly, you can see it in the eyes as well. This is not working. It all comes down to, you know, is Will Sharp good here? Is Paul Bettany good? Will Sharp has nothing on Tom Hulce. Tom Hulce in that film, in the original Amadeus film, he's just a Duracell bunny of a performer. Like, he's just a one-man fireworks show, and it's a Technicolor performance compared to the black and white stuff that Will Sharp has given us. Will Sharp plays Mozart as almost this kind of moody, mumbling Gen Zer. You know, he's just all eye rolls when something doesn't go wrong for him. He stomps his feet. He's a bit too brattish. He's not enjoyable to watch. You're not supposed to love Mozart in this story, but he's just a little bit boring to watch. And I think Bettany Salieri has gone the completely opposite direction. And you could say he's supposed to, but Bettany is playing him as this sort of like tortured, tragic Shakespearean son. You know, that he's annoyed at God for turning his back on him, but Bettany kind of plays him as though he's annoyed at a parent for loving the other kid a little too much. And Bettany has said that that's the way he had to approach the material because he's, you know, not a religious man, so that's how he got into the character. But I just found the tone a bit all over the place.
Okay, this is also from it, and it is Constanza. She interrupts Mozart while he is playing Late Into the Night. Will Sharp as Mozart and Gabrielle Creevy as Constanza.
Wolfgang.
Constanza, is everything all right?
It's 3:00 in the morning.
Is it?
Yes, it is. And most people are asleep. In the quiet.
Ah.
Did you just write this? Can I?
Please. Thank you. Quite good. Is it true what your sister said about you the other night?
My range? Mm-hmm. Yes, I used to dream about it, being a singer. Coloratura soprano. Wanted to be a star, I suppose.
I agreed with you about Armida, by the way. All those boring trails. Only a fool would like something like that.
Maybe not calling my sister a fool.
Oh, I wouldn't dream of it.
Chris, the film is about 2.5 hours. The original stage play about 2 hours, 45, 3 hours or so. This is twice as long, 5 episodes. So what fills out the story?
It's just an awful lot of padding. It sometimes feels as though this series is kind of stuck in slow motion a little bit. A little bit more effort has gone into the, you know, I won't give anything away for anyone who's not familiar with the story, but, you know, there is a great tragedy that Mozart and his wife have to endure as young parents. And then there's also the idea that, you know, Mozart is the way he is because his father wasn't very good to him following the death of his mother, which he holds him responsible for. So maybe there's a bit more in that. There's a trip home to see the dad that takes up an awful lot of time. I mean, you get to, you know, around 3 episodes in and you start thinking to yourself, it's been a while since Salieri and Mozart have been in the same room. And I don't think we had that problem with the film. So slowing things down and drawing things out, I don't think that's really worked for it. Because as I said, when you get to episode 3, you can actually start to hear the airs come out of the tire, you know. So it's all a bit too much. I did enjoy Rory Kinnear. I will always enjoy this story. So I think that's, you know, there's such a fabulous fictionalized story here. But I will also say, after 3 episodes, I started to think to myself, am I building this film up too much in my head? So I went over and I rewatched the first half an hour of the Amadeus film with F. Murray Abraham and Tom Hulce. And that half an hour was way better than anything I watched in this series. It's unfair, I know, to compare the two, but also impossible.
How many stars?
I'm going to go with three because the story's there. I do like Will Sharpe. I love everyone involved in this. I just think that they've had better days. So revisit the original story, but if you've time over the Christmas, go back to the film too.
Okay. I continue to call it Emily in Paris because I got stuck calling it at the very beginning because apparently Darren Starr said it was supposed to be rhyming. Emily, Paris.
Wow, Jen, that's as much thought as he put into that, really.
Jen is giving me that look. So, fans, they will be both delighted and a little sad today because season 5 has dropped on Netflix. It is the last foray for the irrepressible Emily, played by Lily Collins. This time, slightly at odds with the title, she's left Paris and she's moved to Rome, where she is leading Agence Gratteau's new office. Jen, you have watched this for us and all of the series. First question, why does she leave Paris?
I took that for the team, guys. The fromage, the fromage. They're setting up a new office in Rome, ostensibly, but she also had this love interest, Marcello, who in the grand tradition of Emily in Paris, I mean, you have walking cliches in this whole series when you're in Paris, so they might as well be, I don't know, sentient croque monsieurs and croque madames. So in Rome, you have Marcello, who might as well be the Dalmio puppet for all the Italian that he is. This is what this show deals in. It's just a major cliches. So she's there and this plot shakeup, I thought, well, maybe we might get something new, a little bit different, a little bit more pizzazz. No, it's diluted by the fact that everyone in her life ends up joining her in Rome. So that includes her best friend Mindy, her demanding boss Sylvie, her suave new beau, as I said, Marcello. And she does have a new power bob. So I was thinking, okay, there's something different here. Are we going to go into Gone Girl territory finally? Because I do think there's something incredibly terrifying about Emily. I mean, she is just this turbo, I call her capitalism's final girl boss. She's terrifying, a terrifying American. But I will say that when we start this new season, every single person in the agency is sleeping with a different client. I mean, how very French. But also, it's a reminder, I think, within this series that romance, sex, love is all equated with power and money. So at the end of the day, it's still extremely American. You're never going to escape Uncle Sam over here. So Emily is romancing Marcello and trying to win over his mother, who's the head of this very exclusive cashmere brand. I mean, think Missoni. It's kind of a ripoff. And she is trying to convince the mom to let her American capitalist ways trample all over their unique business, basically. That is the loosest plot. She wants to bring the company to the masses and nobody is going to stop this perky, terrifying Autobot that is Emily. And like, I'm really waiting for Emily in Psychosis because there is something so strange about like Lily Collins' performance. It's always the rictus grin, the can-do attitude, the empty values. It's no one can love the vapidness of consumerist culture as much as Emily. And I suppose that is generally the story. I mean, various other mishaps occur with the minor players, but the meat of it is this love triangle that you get with Emily, Marcello, and then Chef, the ex-chef back in Paris, Gabrielle. So we know, because the show is still called Emily in Paris, she's heading back to Paris at some stage. Spoiler alert, guys. Oh my God, it's happening.
This is Emily arriving at their new office and starting to claim her space and laying down some rules to Sylvie, Lily Collins, and as Sylvie Philippine Leroy Beaulieu.
I'm going to meet Antonia and Marcello for lunch.
Wonderful. Looking forward to being part of things when we have something concrete to present.
Right. And also, wasn't this supposed to be my office?
Let's not get hung up on hierarchy, Emily. You're welcome to use that stool when I'm gone.
Since we're sharing, I would appreciate it if you wouldn't smoke in here. Or anywhere in the office, for that matter.
So many rules. If you insist.
I really do. Okay.
Ciao.
What about Minnie Driver? She turns up in this series.
She's excellent, I have to say, because I know a lot of fans are always like, oh my God, it's just an escapist, fluffy watch. Stop being so cynical. Now, Minnie Driver, she knows how to do camp. So she's playing this glamorous grifter. She's an old friend of Sylvie's, a princess without a portfolio, as she calls herself. She was married into Italian royalty, but they can't afford the upkeep of the plot. So she's turned herself into this influencer. And there's something for me a shift in the writing that might be a little bit self-referential. They kind of know, because we've had four other seasons of Hate Watch and what the problems are and what people find so irritating about the blatant advertising and spawn con in Emily in Paris. So they turn it on its head.
I want to ask a question about this before we go any further. The moment with the beer brand, which we shall not name, which Minnie Driver is doing at a party, and she is obviously doing to everybody at the party because they have sponsored it. But that's just product placement, right?
But I also felt it was quite knowing because, I mean, obviously the beer brand asked to be included in Emily in Paris's bulging catalogue of SponCon, but I don't know if they realised they would be promoted in this very obvious, tacky way.
It did feel Truman Show way.
Yeah, it felt a bit meta for me, but I do think that Minnie Driver gives you exactly what you want, and she is responsible for possibly the most thoughtful plotline in the show. Bear with me, where she goes on live on TikTok and she divulges the tiny town where Muratori, the brand, is located. So she's given it away to hundreds of camera-wielding influencers that turn up at the doorstep. And when Emily in Paris first began, it was all about the integration of this new class of marketers and how they were the future. But now it would seem that the show, which used to be their biggest defender, even the show has grown tired of them. So is this a sign of the time? Like, there is this other subplot as well about Antoine from The Office. He rebrands this dud perfume idea that they had that was supposed to be sold for babies, and he makes it the new flagship Muratori scent. So I was thinking, is Darren Starr taking the proverbial out of the Emily in Paris fans and saying they will continue to watch any old crap that he repackages and resells to them? I mean, that was what was happening for me, because I had to find some meaning in this show that has been going on for five seasons.
You've dug hard. Give me some stars, please.
I think the children yearn for Ally McBeal. That's what we really want. Gen Z needs their own Ally McBeal. And I feel like that's what's lost here. She was somebody that was, you know, a bit of an oddball, a bit of a working goofball. She managed to hold things down, though. I mean, even the dancing, ludicrous dancing babies feel more realistic than Emily in Paris. Please bring back those days, is what I say. This is just Nickelodeon. It's like a Nickelodeon film that Hilary Duff would have been in. And that nostalgia is what is going to kill TV. We need to be better than this. We need to be clever into this.
So you're saying a reboot of Ally McBeal is a great idea?
100%. Get it done now.
Give me some stars.
Two for Minnie Driver.
Okay. We're going to look at some TV that's happening between now and the new year. And each of you has brought a few suggestions to the table. Chris, where do you want to start? Fallout Season 2?
Yeah, we'll start with Fallout Season 2. And it is actually hard to believe that it's been almost 2 years since we reviewed the first season of Fallout on Arena. So everyone involved has taken their time with this. And it is, of course, based on the acclaimed role-playing video game series of the same name. And it's a post-apocalyptic fantasy thriller, which is set in a world that has been completely ravaged by nuclear war. And at the beginning, we saw that for North American residents, at least, the survivors of this distant future war, they spend their days in these underground bunkers, waiting for, you know, the wasteland to, you know, waiting to go back up to the surface again. But they can't stay there forever. Something gets in, someone gets out, and we have Ella Purnell's character Lucy escaping one day to discover, you know, 200 days into the future, that life isn't what she thought it would be on the outside. There are flesh-eating mutants on the outside, there are vicious military factions rising up, and also immortal gun-wielding bandits who used to live very ordinary lives as children's parties entertainers, but for Walton Goggins, he is now a bounty hunter with no nose. So in the first season, those two characters got to know one another. We had various other characters like Aaron Morton's Maximus, who used to be part of one of those military factions, starting a war. A lot happened in that first season. There was an awful lot of money involved. The narrative wasn't great, but visually it was quite spectacular. It had people like Jonathan Nolan, brother of Christopher, involved, and people loved it. I think this is an era we live in now where video game adaptations are starting to be taken seriously. There's a lot more effort gone into them. More people are watching. So, of course, you're going to get a second season. And in the second season, we have Lucy, we have the Ghoul, and we have Maximus all joining forces to take a trip to, not Las Vegas, New Vegas. And there they find this Mad Max-like leader, Justin Theroux's Robert Edwin House. He's the leader of the New Vegas Strip. And let's just say things are not going to be all fun for these guys.
Okay, that's season two of Fallout. Jen, Home for Christmas.
Yeah, now less people think I am a Grinch because of what I've just said about Emily in Paris. I do actually have a heart, and so does this show that's on Netflix. It's out now. So this was this Norwegian, it was a kind of sleeper hit, a cult hit, a Norwegian romantic comedy back in 2019 was the first episode, the first season. So the premise has all, it sounds like a cheesy, predictable Hallmark movie, but the writing is so sharp that it makes it very acerbic and really refreshing. It's not exactly festive Fleabag or anything, but it is filled with this cynicism and sardonicness that makes that state of singledom that the main character is in very compelling viewing. So in the first season, it was Johan, who's played by Ida Elise Brosch. She's an excellent actress. She's struggling to cope with the societal pressures on women in their 30s of, you know, she doesn't want to be relegated to the kids' table at celebrations and be the source of her parents' pity. And she invents this boyfriend and gives herself 24 days to find a real life boyfriend for her family's Christmas party. And in the second season, then it was more about her hunt for true love in the face of cynicism. And it was very melancholy almost, because it really came to the conclusion that maybe romantic love is not enough to keep you going in life. So I don't want to spoil it on anybody who wants to binge all three seasons over Christmas, which you definitely should. But this sees Johan is hosting her own Christmas party for her family for the first time, but she's also having this bit of seasonal fun, and this unexpected arrival lands on her doorstep and it sends her romantic life into a tailspin. I really like this because there's so many deep themes there. It's not all built to be a fantasy. There's realism there, and because it is Norwegian after all. It is a bit dour, guys. It's not schmaltzy, it's not saccharine, even if it is centred on romance, and I think that's something that's vital.
And just to remind people that it's called Home for Christmas, because there's a lot of Christmas content on Netflix. Home for Christmas, Netflix out now. A ghost story for Christmas, Chris?
Yeah, this has become something of an annual fixture again for the BBC, which I think is only a good thing. We have Mark Gatiss returning for his eighth Christmas ghost story. Last year's was Woman of Stone with Aina Hardwick. It was a little too tame. I actually preferred the year before, lot number 249, Arthur Conan Doyle's very sinister, spooky bedtime story. Basically, this used to be a series in the 1970s, where every Christmas Eve there would be a half hour horror story with maybe a little bit of a festive streak. It came back in 2005 and it's been on and off ever since, but Mark has been involved for the last eight specials. And this year it is based on an E.F. Benson short horror story, which was originally published in 1912, but the action has actually been updated to 1940. It's called The Room in the Tower, and it's about a man named Roger, played by Tobias Menzies, who is sheltering during an air raid with a Women's Auxiliary Air Force officer named Verity, played by Nancy Carroll. And they get to talking, and they get to talking about dreams, as you do, and he tells her about this haunting vision that he's had since he was about 15 or 16, where every night he goes to sleep, he has this nightmare where he's standing outside a mysterious house, not unlike the house of a classmate who he wasn't really good pals with to begin with, and he's being urged to come into this house by an elderly woman and also a family he doesn't recognise. That elderly woman is played by Joanna Lumley, and every time he has this dream, the woman gets a little bit older, and she's always telling him to stay in this room in a tower overlooking the house. And when he gets there, he senses this unseen, unidentified terror, and he knows that something is going to go terribly wrong here. He doesn't know what it means, but sometime later in real life, he is called over to a real pal's house to meet this pal's family for the first time. And what do you know? The house is actually identical to the house that he's been dreaming of. So what happens next? You might be wondering, what does it all mean? That would be telling. I'm not going to tell you, but these things usually come with a twist, and I'm very much looking forward to seeing what that twist is.
Okay, I think we're going to take one more, and we probably should do Stranger Things, because it is the final package of episodes in two batches over the course of Christmas and New Year.
Yes, and like, listen, people are probably sitting here thinking, well, you just gave out about Stranger Things a couple of weeks ago. You gave it 2.5 out of 5 or something, but
I am
nothing if not a completist, and I didn't start watching this hokum show back in the pre-pandemic era in 2016 not to see this through. And Netflix knows that. The Duffer Brothers know that. So they know that they have this guaranteed worldwide captive audience ready to see how this all ends. So it's season 5, it's Stephen's Day and then New Year's Eve, I think. And I think splitting up the final season is nothing new for Netflix, but I feel like having them drop on two holiday days is pretty ingenious. I mean, I'm not exactly thrilled about the Godfather length runtime of these episodes. About 2 hours, I think, is the finale. Does this particular story deserve that? No. Have they completely eradicated the charm of the first season? Yes, because they're making it all about an individual baddie rather than an inexplicable evil, which I loved about Stranger Things. Does it sound like the Duffer Brothers don't really know where they're going or how to finish this? Yes. Has it all gone a bit Marvel instead of Spielberg? Yes. But I want to see a lid put on the horrors of Hawkins once and for all. And I've been saying for the past 4 seasons that if a main character needs, they need to die. Because if they don't, it's all for naught. I mean, have we learnt nothing from Star Wars? We need that emotional devastation. We've been investing in this for the past 9 years. But when it comes down to it, when I watch the trailer for the final season, if they touch a hair on Steve Harrington's bountiful hairdo, they'll have killed my Christmas. They will have killed it. I don't want this.
And you're right. For those of us who watched everything up until now, there's pretty much nothing that's going to stop us watching this two sets of episodes.
And they know that damn well.
Thank you so much for coming in for all of the reviews across the course of the year. Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser. Chris, you're going to be back with us on Tuesday night to check out some of the best TV of 2025 as well. But thank you so much for joining us tonight on Arena. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. If you're lucky enough to have a genuine culture lover in your life, but you haven't quite settled on a present yet, there's still time and we have some ideas. A book is always a great one. Bookshops will all still be open right the way up until the very last moment on Christmas Eve. Adele Coffey joins me now with her wish list and some books which should keep everybody entranced and engrossed over the next while. Adele, thanks for joining us. We're going to start with your favourite books that you're recommending. So obviously so many people, they don't have time to read across the course of a year. They're working, but this is a great time to be doing it. So where would you like to start? Your book of the year is probably a good place to go.
Okay, yeah, and I agree with you, Rick. I really feel like Christmas is the perfect time where it's I think it's the one remaining time in our calendar where you're actually left alone for a day or two and people stop calling. So it's a perfect time to pick up a book. My book of the year, and I think author of the year in many ways, is Andrea Mara. It Should Have Been You is her latest book that came out earlier this summer. Now, people will be familiar with her because her book, All Her Fault, was recently made into a TV series starring Sarah Snook, and it's up for 2 Emmys now, and it's a huge success. But if you like that series, that's the kind of book she writes. It Should Have Been You has this runaway plot that basically starts with this with the protagonist called Susan. She accidentally sends this really gossipy text about her neighbors and their children and who's having an affair, and she sends it off. She thinks to her sisters, but actually she sends it to the entire neighborhood WhatsApp group. And within 24 hours, somebody is dead. And we think it's a case of mistaken identity. And it's kind of, we think it's all Susan's fault as well. So, you know, it starts at that breakneck speed and it doesn't let up. And if you're looking for something really enjoyable and really twisty and plotty to read over Christmas, this is the one. And I just think she's really going from strength to strength. She's an amazing success. She's sold 1 million copies of her books in the last year. So we're going to be hearing a lot more about her, I think. But really, she really delivers, you know, on the plot and the story.
It's a fine, fine choice. It's been a great year for Andrea. You've chosen Claire Louise Bennett's new book as well. Tell us who she is.
Yeah, no, this is a completely different kind of book. This is for... it's basically anyone who knows Claire Louise Bennett, she is considered one of the most exciting sort of formalists writing today. She's published by Fitzcarraldo, who generally publish a lot of work in translation, a lot of Nobel Prize winners. She's a very beautiful writer. This book is sort of overtly about this woman who is sort of transplanted from the city to the countryside. She has to move away from her home. And she's also trying to sort of unwind a romantic relationship with this older man called Xavier. But actually, it's so deeply and profoundly thought out. It's a meditation on what the experience of being with somebody is, how relationships can transform us, how they can change, you know, how they can just be over in your head within a second, and then about the process of letting go. Very just very profound, very moving, and unusually for someone who writes in this very deep way, I find her very readable. You know, there's nothing difficult about her work. She's a brilliant writer, and she really sort of absorbs you in a way that not a lot of literary writers. Sometimes they're more difficult to get into, but I think she's got a very unusual gift there. And this is only her third book. But she's a brilliant writer as well. I presume you like Claire Louise, Rick, do you?
Yeah, I read that this year amongst many other things, and I enjoyed
it. Isn't
it
lovely?
It yeah.
So moving.
John Banville, you've suggested as well. He's back with another novel this year. Why are you recommending Venetian Vespers?
Well, because I just love John Banville. And actually, I think John Banville and likewise Anne Enright, they're two of our best known novelists. And I think sometimes we forget to give them the love they deserve because they really are brilliant and they just keep getting better. And John Banville's Venetian Vespers, he's so funny in this book. He's so snarky, and you know, his humor is so sophisticated. Basically, it tells the story of this sort of hack writer, this English guy called Evelyn Dahlman, who has married this very wealthy American, daughter of this very wealthy American. And, you know, all is not as it seems. And they finally get around to taking a much sort of delayed honeymoon in Venice. And things don't go to plan, let's just say. I really enjoyed this, but also I found it's so clever and so funny, as John Banville always is. And I think we sometimes forget how good he is. So that's why he's in my book of the year.
For your suggestion, now I want people to bear with you for a minute, because you've suggested a 600-page novel here as well. I'm all with you on this. If I can find something that will make me last a month and is well worth it, I don't have a problem with that. So this is Jonas Hassan Kemiri's The Sisters.
Yeah, and listen, I would never recommend a 600-page book to anybody if it wasn't really, really worth it. And I picked this. This came up earlier in the summer. He's a Swedish-Tunisian author. He's really well known in Sweden. He's a big star there, like a literary star. But this was the first time I had actually come across him, to my shame. This is the first one he's written directly in English. And it's called The Sisters. It's about these three sisters who are also Tunisian Swedish. But what's so absorbing about this is you just immediately are completely taken with the characters. They're so strong and they're so completely distinct. It really reminded me of the first time I read Jonathan Franzen's The Corrections. And I've also been comparing this to Paul Murray's The Bee Sting. So if you like those kind of books about families, about, you know, how families influence us, about how the bonds of marriage have an effect on the children of those marriages, and also just sort of that very long shadow that can be cast by our parents, our grandparents, and our families of origin. It's all about identity. That sounds very highfalutin. This actually reads like a really pacey thriller. The chapters are really short. It's the characters, the three sisters, are so involving. There's also a fourth character called Jonas, the same name as the author. So there's this wonderful blurring of lines as well. And this book, to me, I opened it just one summer's day and I thought I'll have a quick look at this. And really, it was one of those ones that I just ignored everybody for hours and couldn't stop reading it. So yeah, it's 600 pages, but you don't feel it go. It's really, really good. And actually, the New York Times had this in their top 10 books of the year. So I haven't heard too much about it over this side of the Atlantic, but I think it's doing well in America.
Sometimes I think a 600-page book that you love, you'll read as quickly as a 200-page book that
exactly.
You're slogging your way through. So yeah, I want to get to nonfiction. You have a couple of suggestions here as well. You've chosen Stephen Gross's Love's Labour. What's that about?
Oh, I'm obsessed with Stephen Gross. So people will probably remember Stephen Gross from his book, which was called The Examined Life. And it was basically, it just kind of came out of nowhere. He's the psychoanalyst and he's been practicing for decades. And he wrote this sort of best-selling nonfiction book, which was just a kind of, it was almost like Esther Perel. If people know Esther Perel, he was like Esther Perel before she had her podcast. So he wrote this book. It was all of his sort of case studies, obviously disguised, or he had permission from his patients to write them. And it was so fascinating because it went into the most strange, unusual human behavior. And as well as that, he has all of this insight and knowledge and experience as a very, very, very good psychoanalyst. that he could reflect on it. Now, this one is the second book, and it's called Love's Labour, and it's focusing on love and relationships. And the flip side of love is hate, and there is divorce and all sorts of things in here. But my goodness, the details in these case studies are so fascinating. Like some of them about a husband who thinks his wife is having an affair. I don't think I can say on radio some of the details, but they're so fascinating, and what the human mind is capable of believing, and how he traces back why the people behave in this way to, you know, their childhoods, often to, you know, what their relationship with their parents were like. It's just utterly fascinating. And I can't recommend this one enough. This is actually one of my favorite books of the year.
I want to make sure we get to mention some of your suggestions for book lovers that aren't actually books, well, not individual books anyway.
Yes.
So book subscriptions. Tell me about that.
Yeah. Well, like if you go into any bookshop, you'll find they're doing lovely Christmas packages. Like Kenny's do a books hamper, Kenny's in Galway. Hodges Figgis in Dublin do an annual subscription, and they will tailor it. So you can get one for people who love art, you can get one for non-fiction lovers, and they range in price. So if you select the paperback fiction, you know, you get one book a year for one book a month for the year, and that costs €250. So it's pricey enough, but it's a really nice gift that keeps on giving. Then I was thinking as well, I've given this myself as gifts, a lovely gift is a subscription to one of the periodicals like the Dublin Review or the Stinging Fly or the New Yorker or the Paris Review if you want to go more international. And they're not very expensive. I think the Dublin Review and the Stinging Fly are somewhere in and around 50, I think. So a little bit more affordable and really nice. Again, you keep getting these lovely presents in the post throughout the year, and I love that. Also a nice one, I think we're verging into film love now, but I think a Criterion subscription or a Mubi subscription. Also Masterclass and Maestro, you know those websites. Maestro is run by the BBC, and then there's the Masterclass website, and a lot of them have brilliant writers giving writing classes. So on Masterclass you've got Margaret Atwood, you've got Dan Brown, and on Maestro you've got Harlan Coben. You know, so you're getting these brilliant workshops essentially from some of the best in the business.
Well, those are the virtual ones, Adele. I'm interested in your suggestion that you've given us for a writing course, but it's one that you might need to very much love somebody and somebody for to be very serious about it. This is the Claire Keegan one.
Okay, so I adore Claire Keegan. I love her books, and I'm sure a lot of people do as well. Her writing is incredible. But people might not know that Claire Keegan has taught fiction writing for a very long time. And actually, I think that might be how she got into writing fiction herself. She runs a website called ckfictionclinic.com. So if people want to go there, they can find out about this workshop, this class that she's running in May next year in Iceland, and it's called How Fiction Works. And it's €3,000, and that's just for the tuition. So you'd have to book your flights and your accommodation. But I did a workshop with her in Dublin. It wasn't a residential one. It was 2 days. It was so brilliant. She is so practical in what she teaches you. And she's so friendly as well. You might think, you know, it might be intimidating, but she's very encouraging, very open, so kind to so many people who are in the class. And it had all sorts of people. There were authors there, published authors. And then there were, you know, people who were trying to write a story, people who were trying to write for the first time. And she treated everybody exactly the same. And she was just so practical and brilliant. I just think, imagine flying to Iceland and to go to a class with Claire Keegan, and just even imagine the kind of people you'd meet on that course. I think that would be a great gift if anyone's got €3,000 to spare.
It is for somebody you love very, 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 very much. Just maybe in the last couple of minutes I have with you, Adele, very briefly, the idea of pens, notebooks, that kind of thing.
Listen, if you have a book lover in your life, chances are they're going to be obsessed with stationery and pens. I love stationery. I think a beautiful gift, if you are into that, is some note cards. I wanted to mention a brilliant Irish company called Plunkett Press, and you just find them plunkettpress.com. They make these beautiful sort of very manually made, actually, embossed cards and, you know, letterheads. Just really beautiful. A fancy pen, you can't beat a Mont Blanc, but you can get a lovely gold or silver plated pen for as little as 30 euros. And it's always so special because every time you use that pen, you kind of think of the person who bought it for you, or you'll take care of it because it feels a bit more special. So, or a luxury notebook. I love Smithson. They're
Smithson, that's new to me.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry because I've opened the door to this for you, Rick. I apologize. They're very expensive. However, I did find a portal in TK Maxx where they sell them for something like 40 euros. So keep your eyes peeled in TK Maxx, is all I will say.
So everything from individual books all the way up to a 3,500 euro class with Claire Keegan. It's been brilliant. Adele Coffey, have a lovely Christmas and thank you so much for joining us tonight on Arena. We're back in a moment to finish out tonight's programme with something a little special. Christmas is nearly upon us, not that you need reminding, but we thought we'd finish up tonight and take a pause and remember how some of our finest writers have remembered Christmases in Ireland. First up is Anne Enright reading from her novel The Green Road, where her character Constance, weary and at the beck and call of her elderly mother, is facing into the dreaded Christmas supermarket shop.
The next morning she went early into Ennis. It was 10 a.m. on Christmas Eve and the supermarket was like the apocalypse. People grabbing without looking and things falling in the aisles. But there was no good time to do this. You just had to get through it. Constance pushed her trolley to the vegetable section. Celery, carrots, parsnips for Desi, who liked them, sage for the stuffing, an experimental bag of chestnuts, vacuum packed. Constance bought a case of Prosecco on special offer to wrap and leave on various doorsteps and threw in 8 frozen pizzas in case the kids rolled up with friends, frozen berries, different ice cream. She got wine, sherry, whiskey, fresh nuts, salted nuts, crisps, bags and bags of apples, 2 mangoes, a melon, dark cherries with the fruit salad, root ginger, fresh mint, a wooden crate of satsumas, the fruit cold and promising sweet, each one with its own sprig of green dark leaves. She got wrapping paper, of course, red paper, napkins, sellotape, and more out of habit now the children were grown, packs and packs of batteries, AAA, AA, a few C's. She took 5 squat candles in cream-coloured beeswax to fill the cracked hearth in her mother's house and 2 long rolls of simple red baubles to fill the gaps on her old-fashioned tree. She went back for more sausages then because she'd forgotten about breakfast. Tomatoes, bacon, eggs. She went back to the dairy section for more cheese, back to the fruit aisle for seedless grapes, back to the biscuit aisle for water biscuits. She searched high and low for string to keep the cloth on the pudding, stopped at the delicatessen counter for pesto, chicken liver pate, tubs of olives. She got some ready-cooked drumsticks just to keep people going. At every corner, she met a neighbour, an old friend. They rolled their eyes and threw Christmas greetings and no one thought her rude for not stopping to converse. She smiled at a baby in the queue for the till. "Yes," she said, "I know." The baby considered her fully. The baby gave her a look that was complete. "I know," she said again and got the curl of a sweet, thoughtful smile. All this kept Constance occupied until the time came to unload the contents of her trolley onto the conveyor. The baby held itself so proudly erect. The young mother underneath it looked like a prop. She looked like some kind of clapped out baby stand. "You're doing great," Constance told her. "You're doing a great job." The bill came to 410 euros. A new record. She thought she should keep the receipt for posterity. Desi would be almost proud. Constance pushed her trolley onto the walkway and the wheels locked cleverly onto the metal beneath them and she was happy, happy, happy as she sank towards the car park. She thanked God from the burning, rising depth of herself for this unexpected life. A man who loved her, 2 sons taller than their father, and a daughter who kissed her still when there was no one there to see. She couldn't believe this is the way things had turned out. Her feet were swollen. She could feel them throb, hot in the wrong shoes. Constance bumped the trolley off the walkway, set her trotters thumping across the concrete of the car park. It was 11:30 on Christmas Eve. In the pocket of her coat, her phone started to ring, and by the telepathy of the timing, Constance knew it was her mother. "What is it, darling?" she said, remembering as she did so that she had forgotten the Brussels sprouts.
It's the brilliant Anne Enright from a recording she made on the Sean O'Rourke Show in December 2019. To the great Joseph O'Connor, this is his piece, Into the Mystic, an Irish Christmas, recorded for RTE Radio 1 in 2016.
One foggy Christmas night, when I was about 6 or 8, I remember that I had a bad dream. It's more than 40 years ago now, so I don't recollect what scared me. But I remember waking up in the early hours of the morning, and the room being dark, and my late grandmother being there. Perhaps I was staying in her house, maybe she was in ours. But in any case, I remember how soothing and gentle she was. "There was nothing to be scared of in the night," she said, "especially on Christmas night. The night was a gift, if you were lucky enough to be sleeping in a safe, warm house. And it was well known," she added, "that on a dark and foggy night like this, God and the angels kept a special watch on children. If you listened," she told me, "you could hear the trumpet of the angels." And we listened together, and I heard it. The sound itself, looking back, was more like a bassoon than a trumpet, or maybe even slightly like a tuba. But most of all, it was like itself. Out of the night, like a strange note of comfort, came the sound of one of Ireland's foghorns. Reassuring, soothing, strong but calming, one of the night presences that spoke of the angels. Sailors would come home, storms would be survived, all would be well with the world. I grew up in a coast town, and when you're living on a small island, you're never too far from the sea. One of the most gorgeous things about Ireland. The sea is our opera, always beautiful to look at, no matter the season or the weather. But I can say that on those nights when I couldn't see it at all, those stormy or foggy nights when I was listening in bed, it seemed a tide of memories and stories. The distant foghorn would sound, as it sounded through so many of our childhoods and so many of our adolescences and adulthoods too. And somehow it spoke of the realm of heart's desire. As Shakespeare has it, "Be not afeard, the isle is full of noises, sounds and sweet airs that give delight and hurt not. But when I waked, I cried to dream again.
Underneath the stars I'll meet you, underneath the stars I'll greet you.
A couple of years ago, alas, the last Irish foghorn sounded. In the modern and efficient world we live in now, there is no need anymore for the trumpet of the angels. GPS technology has replaced all that. The orchestra of the night has lost something more than its brass section. That mournful yet consoling piece of the Irish night song is to vanish into the republic of silenced sounds. The place where Charles Mitchell is still reading the news, and where Frankie Byrne is never far away, accompanied by Frank Sinatra and that heaney of the airwaves, Micheál O'Hare is painting his pictures with words. It's a country of church bells that are rung, not recorded. A place where it's still possible to hear the clop of horses delivering milk. It's the country where the Wanderley wagon is rolling down a laneway, while Mr. Crow goes squabbling with Judge. It's the country of the past, where Ciarán MacMahona is speaking on McCheolhu, the land the Angelus comes from and the sound of the corn crakes. Not long ago, it was reported in the newspapers that the bittern has returned to Ireland, that bird which people of my own age will remember from the Leaving Cert as An Bunann Bui. But now, as if to even out the score, Ireland's foghorns are gone forever. The last one has sounded, we are officially modern. A small, insignificant, unimportant loss. And nothing to the losses so many have known. But the thought that my own children will never hear the trumpet of the angels, and that I myself will never hear it again, is for me a slightly sad one, and I don't think I'm alone. Only a few weeks ago, during the cold of mid-December, I was walking near the sea one night when I heard it call to me from the darkness. It was a voice that spoke of the people who were our lighthouses when we were lost and afraid, our beacons, our watchtowers, our lifeboats. A voice that said to all of us, you are not alone. A voice that told our knights, there are angels.
That was Joseph O'Connor reading Into the Mystic, an Irish Christmas, produced by our own Sian O'Gorman. We'll finish with one of the great literary Irish Christmases. Here, Stephen Ray reads the final part of James Joyce's The Dead.
He stretched himself cautiously along under the sheets and lay down beside his wife. One by one, they were all becoming shades. Better pass boldly into that other world, in the full glory of some passion, than fade and wither dismally with age. He thought of how she who lay beside him had locked in her heart for so many years that image of her lover's eyes when he had told her that he did not wish to live. Generous tears filled Gabriel's eyes. He had never felt like that himself towards any woman. But he knew that such a feeling must be love. The tears gathered more thickly in his eyes, and in the partial darkness he imagined he saw the form of a young man standing under a dripping tree. Other forms were near. His soul had approached that region where dwell the vast hosts of the dead. He was conscious of, but could not apprehend, their wayward and flickering existence. His own identity was fading out into a grey, impalpable world. The solid world itself, which these dead had one time reared and lived in, was dissolving and dwindling. A few light taps upon the pane made him turn to the window. It had begun to snow again. He watched sleepily the flakes, silver and dark, falling obliquely against the lamplight. The time had come for him to set out on his journey westward. Yes, the newspapers were right. Snow was general all over Ireland. It was falling on every part of the dark central plain, on the treeless hills, falling softly upon the bog of Allen, and farther westward, softly falling into the dark, mutinous Shannon waves. It was falling, too, upon every part of the lonely churchyard on the hill where Michael Fury lay buried. It lay thickly drifted on the crooked crosses and headstones, on the spears of the little gate, on the barren thorns. His soul swooned slowly as he heard the snow falling faintly through the universe, and faintly falling, like the descent of their last end, upon all the living and the dead.
That's Stephen Ray reading from The Dead. It was a drama on one recording from January of this year. I hope that's given you a few minutes of pause in what is bound to be the chaos of the next few days. This coming Monday is the inaugural Arena Christmas Arts Quiz. Two teams of our finest reviewers will take each other on in a quiz with questions covering everything in the arts and popular culture. And then on Tuesday, we have a panel looking back at the absolute best of music, film, TV and books in 2025. Both of those are at our usual time of 7 p.m. And also over Christmas, we have a two-part special, The Essential Sean Rocks, with the best of Sean's recent interviews on Arena, presented by Kieran Hines. Part one is 4 o'clock on New Year's Eve, and part two is 4 o'clock on New Year's Day. That is it for Arena for this week, produced by Sinead Egan tonight. Ollie Hamilton was our broadcast coordinator. Harry Bookless was on sound supervision. John Creedon is next, and I will talk to you on Monday night from 7 o'clock.